Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, it seemed like a busier week because we had lots of mini films to sneak into some of the bigger films. We're going to talk sequel to the Lego movie. We're going to talk remake, reboot, homage with What Men Want. You went solo on a remake. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about a whole bunch of little tiny Oscar-nominated short films. But first, I brought the wine this week.
You did.
Let's see what you can do with this.
The Naked Grape. It is a Harvest Red blend out of California. The Naked Grape. I don't know. Did that have something to do with What Men Want?
It did. Maybe? What do men want?
I don't know. I can't read your minds, you know?
Well, the moral of the story is, no, you cannot know what men want by reading their minds because you can't see our hearts, Hannah.
Oh, but I think the moral of What Men Want is that in the end, you can if you're open to seeing what's in the men's hearts.
But you know what? We're jumping ahead. I don't even want to start with that movie because it's not going to be the biggest movie of the week.
What will be the biggest movie of the week, Charlie?
The terribly titled, choppy, The Lego Movie 2, the second part. I loved The Lego Movie. This is before Lego Batman spinoff. This is before Lego Ninjago. In 2014, The Lego Movie came out and it made my top 10 of the entire year. It was absolutely my favorite animated film, and it was not nominated for an Oscar. Big scandal back then, if you can remember, 4 years ago. They're back. Emmett Brickowski, voiced by Chris Pratt. Lucy, a.k.a. Wild Style, voiced by Elizabeth Banks. They no longer live in Bricksburg. They live in, what is it, Apocalypseburg. And things have changed. Things have changed, Hannah. Why have things changed? What happened between the end of the last film and the beginning of this film?
I can't remember. I think there must have been some sort of alien invasion kind of thing going on that turned Bricksburg into sort of this Mad Max Fury Road looking landscape, and it's very desolate and everybody is just sort of walking around sad and depressed except for good old Emmett, who has built this cheery little house and is obviously trying to has high hopes that maybe Lucy will be moving in someday, I think. So I couldn't really remember how exactly that last one ended. And why it was so apocalyptic when it opened.
Because the big reveal from the Lego movie is the Legos weren't just being Legos and being themselves. They were being controlled. They were being controlled by a real-life human family. Remember, Will Ferrell was actually President Business, and his son wanted to just play with the Legos. But President Business wanted to glue them. You know, once you set up Legos, they are now in stasis for all time. And by the end, President Business realized, loosen up, let's just play with Legos. Now, it's not just the older brother who gets to play, it's the little sister who has created the Sistar system. She wants to play. Older brother doesn't want to play, so he's created some fortifications called Apocalypseburg. And the Duplo blocks, which are, you know, big, for those of you who don't have kids, are bigger Legos, harder to swallow. Duplo invaders invade Apocalypseburg, and they kidnap Lucy, Batman, Lego Batman, voiced by Will Arnett, the pirate guy,
Unikitty.
That's Alison Brie, by the way. The main leading Lego characters, and spirits them back to the Sistar system. There's gonna be a marriage, just like a little girl would dream up. The marriage between Queen Whatever Wanna Be, voiced by Tiffany Haddish, and Lego Batman. And Emmett Brickowski is like, I'm going to get you back, Lucy. I'm going to get you back. So he's got his own mission, and he runs into Rex Dangervest, also
voiced by Chris Pratt.
Rex Dangervest is a galaxy archaeologist, cowboy, and raptor trainer.
Just like Chris Pratt in all of his other movies.
What this all
wink,
adds
wink,
up to
nod, nod.
Is why it's still funny. There's one liner every 30 seconds. They're very pop culture hyper aware. It's funny. It's less special. It's less than. I didn't cherish it like I cherished the first film. I wasn't genuinely thrilled. I didn't laugh as much. I didn't care as much. It's less. The last one had some existentialism, some really deep stuff going on.
Yeah.
This one does not. This one is a standard adventure tale, whereas the other one actually superseded that.
It's always hard when you're trying to build on something that actually was just so refreshing and cool and fun. I think it does a good job, though. It's not as good as the first one. I also don't think it's as good as the Lego Batman movie, which was a standalone in, I think, 2017. And so I read a headline. I think it was our fellow critic, Jason Fraley, who wrote, "Everything is average." So you think of the song "Everything is Awesome," which became a popular tune after the first Lego movie. And it's like, I would say everything is pretty average, but maybe slightly above average, because when you put it in the context of other animated adventures that come out, this one is still very good. It's very entertaining. It's got a lot of just earworms, tunes that are going to stick with you.
Well, it acknowledges the impact on society the first film had. Mm-hmm. It makes fun of "Everything is Awesome" because it changes some words around. And it even introduces a new song, knowing exactly what it did last time. And the new song is called "This Song Will Get Stuck in Your Head."
That's right. It's another catchy ditty. And I do think that the addition of Tiffany Haddish, her voiceover is, she voices the Queen Whatever Wanabi, and I think she's kind of fun, and she's got this thing for Batman, who's considers himself to be this brooding bachelor forever, and she's got to sort of try and brainwash him and convince him that, she sort of makes him jealous by talking about the Man of Steel. And it's a lot of tongue-in-cheek, but I don't think they interweave. I mean, they do have the live action once in a while with the brother and the sister who are kind of fighting over their Lego toys, and mom's getting a little annoyed, played by Maya Rudolph. And so it's not quite as seamless with those.
Well, they have a lot more live action this time.
It does, but it just sort of takes you out each time.
Oh yeah, it's very jumpy. It's not smooth. There are jokes for kids again, and there are jokes for parents.
Yeah.
Kids will not understand why Bruce Willis crawling through ductwork is funny.
Right.
But it's hysterical.
It's funny for the rest of us. And I do think that's what makes this still so viable of a franchise. I they have to be careful because you need to make sure you can deliver a consistently good script. Moves at such a frenetic pace that even if something's not working, you're past it before you can really think too hard on it.
There's a change. Phil Lord and Christopher Miller still wrote it. But they did not direct it this time. They handed that off to Mike Mitchell, Shrek Forever After, and Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Mike Mitchell.
Another classic.
So there's a change in just feeling a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't all work perfectly, but it still kind of works. And that's why, I think it's still, there's a reason that it hopefully will win the box office.
I think it'll win, but there's word on the street it's going to lose a bunch of money.
It could. I mean, again, it's not as strong as the first one, but that's because you're really just seeing more of the same. And so when you've already been exposed to a lot of the gags, I still love Will Arnett's Batman. I mean, to me, you take Batman away out of this whole equation, and these movies are not nearly as fun or as good. So, to me, the Chris Pratt voiced character is still sort of leading this whole group, but really, Batman's a scene stealer.
Yeah, there's not too much to say about it. It took what once was really great and just tried again.
And made it good.
Yeah,
it's still okay. Good.
Well, compared to most, even the five Oscar-nominated animated films this year, this one's better than a couple of them.
Exactly. And so when you figure we're in February, I always wonder whether something like this will get so lost over the year. You know, will there be four better animated movies between now and the next award season that Lego Movie 2 could...
Well, it's not the highest bar.
No, it's not the highest bar, but I do love the... It's got so far the probably the best end credit scene.
Yeah, the Lonely Island do a song on that. It's very amusing, and they're acknowledging how silly end credits can be.
Yeah, but it's like 6 minutes long, and everybody stayed with it. I mean, you were watching. You were truly watching those end credits, and along with this very catchy tune that is telling you, you are sitting here watching the end credits, and you are going to watch them all and enjoy it. And so it leaves everyone, I think, at least pretty much with a smile on their face, which is really pretty much all you can hope for with a February movie.
And only after the fact did we realize the little sister Bianca is played by Brooklyn Prince. Brooklyn Prince was Mooney in the Florida Project. She's a little girl in the Florida Project.
Yeah, so she doesn't have much to do in this particular film, but it is nice to kind of to see her grow a little bit.
Well, we've seen. Well, we hinted at this next film earlier, and talking about growing and completing a full character arc, let's talk about What Men Want. Now, when I immediately saw that there was a movie called What Men Want, a woman who could hear men's thoughts and react either appropriately or inappropriately, I thought it was A, going to be a sequel, B, just a remake with a gender switch, or C, maybe the universe's connect or don't connect. How, Hannah, does What Men Want connect to What Women Want?
It is just a gender swap, I think. Whether you'd call it a reboot or a remake with the gender reversal, I don't know. But in 2000, you had Nancy Myers directing this comedy, romantic comedy, I guess, called What Women Want with Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt. And Gibson in that one played this chauvinistic executive who has some crazy mishap that gives him the ability to hear women's inner thoughts. And of course, by the end, you know, is much more attuned to understanding women. And then you've got, in this case, Taraji P. Henson. She is modern day. She's a sports agent in this boys network of, at the sports agency, where she's passed over for a promotion that she really should have gotten to a partner in this sports agency. And lo and behold, you know, she's got to figure out how to connect better with men. And what better way than to somehow end up going to a psychic during a friend's bachelorette party, drinking some wackadoodle tea, and suddenly waking up the next morning and being able to hear what men want and what their inner thoughts are. And there you have the 2019 version of an attempt to recreate the 2000 version of a romantic dramedy. So, I don't know. It didn't work as well for me. I didn't love it. A lot of people around us did laugh a lot. It's got like a 40-something on the Rotten Tomatoes. But then I saw one review today where somebody gave it 4 out of 5 stars, which I thought was absolutely ridiculous. So it's okay. It's got some funny moments, but it's bloated with its supporting cast. It tries to do way too much, and it doesn't really have the level of insight and smarts that I think the 2001 had. Or when you're talking sports agent chick flick, nothing tops Jerry Maguire, and they're a little pieces of Jerry Maguire wannabe, I think, in this film.
My biggest problem with What Men Want is that it just started to feel obligatory. I knew everything that was going to happen. It was so stock. It was so familiar. Once I learned the central conflict, she was passed over, and her boss says, yeah, you don't connect well with men, and just stay in your lane, you know, with your WNBA stars and whatnot. And once I learned, okay, the big crux is getting better at work, and she in a state of hubris, she says, I'll show you. I'm going to sign the number one NBA draft prospect. And it turns out that kid's father is Tracy Morgan, who is kind of like, if you know who LeVar Ball is, he's a knockoff LeVar Ball. But he acts just as zany as Tracy Morgan normally does. Mm-hmm. And this is not a guy that Taraji P. Henson, a.k.a. her name is Ali Davis, can connect with. Thank goodness she gets her... She actually gets her special power from knocking her head on a wall. But she thinks she gets it from the psychic, who's played by the best supporting character, Erykah Badu. She is hysterical and awesome as the fake psychic slash weed seller named Sister. She's dealing out the tarot cards, and in the middle she deals out an Uno card. And that was by far my biggest laugh. Straight up there with one of Ollie's friends. She's always the girl at the table who says, "Now that I have found the Lord Jesus Christ." But she mentions that she used to follow Two Life Crew on tour. That got my second biggest laugh. And that actually says something. If I can remember my two hearty biggest laughs, and they're both throwaway supporting characters, then the film is lacking. The main transformance is when she meets the love interest, Will the bartender, played by Aldis Hodge. He's MC Ren, by the way, from Straight Outta Compton.
And both of them, by the way, Taraji P. Henson and him, were both in Hidden Figures.
Was he in Hidden
Figures? He was.
She needs to learn how to connect with a man. When they first have a sex scene, it's terrible. It's all about power, and it's extremely it's the unsexiest sex scene you've ever seen. She by listening to his inner monologue a little bit, she improves as kind of a human being. There's really far less than meets the eye in What Men Want. I was disappointed. There's so many laughs you think you could run into here, but they just kept it so safe.
It was very stock. And so while Taraji P. Henson has shown that she definitely can do both comedy and drama, you know, she's big now on TV's Empire. She just got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. She was in Hidden Figures. She was in Benjamin Button several years back. But
that was her Oscar nomination.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's good. It's the material that fails her. So I think, you know, she services this comedy drama fairly well. She can kind of walk the walk. But it telegraphs everything that is going to happen. And everything is sort of this gender reversal where really the love interest is the sensitive one who's got the inner thoughts that she really needs to draw from. And they try so hard to shove all these cameos in there. You've got like the standard poker game with Mark Cuban and Shaq, and then you've got a couple of real NBA stars in there. And
I'm going to go ahead and fill in the blanks for you because I don't think you watched his basketball as enough as some people. Grant Hill was sitting at that poker table, and there's a big scene with Karl Anthony Towns.
I know Karl Anthony Towns, you know, for his little cameo. And then there was also this WNBA pioneer, Lisa Leslie. But one thing I've learned from watching all these movies over the years is great athletes do not great actors make. I mean, occasionally, like Shaq is,
Shaq does
well. But I think back to like Kevin Durant and Thunderstruck, and it's hard to get past that one.
I think the biggest double take of the person who sneaks on screen is Pete Davidson.
Yeah.
Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson. He's been in the news, just in the pop culture entertainment news, so much for the past year that when you actually see him pop up in a film, you're like, A, it's good to see you, buddy. Glad to see you're still here.
Yeah.
You might actually really be somebody someday. So it's interesting to see him pop up in a little tiny role here, but he plays it okay.
Yeah, that's just it. Everybody was sort of okay in their roles, but you've seen them all. Like, every single one of these roles you've seen in all these other similar themed films. You have the assistant, who's very, you know, he plays it well, but he's that just stressed, over-abused assistant who wants to be an agent himself and, you know, is sort of having to serve Ali all the time and be like her little confidant. And then you've got all the gal pals, who's getting married, and you've got this throwaway bachelor party.
They're interchangeable.
And a throwaway wedding where, of course, you know, everything kind of has to go to hell in a handbasket during the wedding. And, you know, then you've got the poker game and you've got the backstabbing coworkers, and they just try to put everything in here. Even with the love interest, Will is a single dad who's got like this five-year-old kid. And you can just see from a mile away where this story is going. And he's just is nowhere near like as good as the cute kid in Jerry Maguire who just
oh come
just
on don't
grabbed
even,
your heart.
No, that's ridiculous. Yeah, don't compare.
It's hard. You can't. But that's all I kept thinking was I really just felt like watching Jerry Maguire again.
Well, I want to end on a positive note. Yeah, it's kind of a downer movie, but you know what? I found myself digging the soundtrack. I've been playing it for the past couple days now. When she first spies Will at the bar, TLC's Creep is playing, which is perfect. when she's feeling really confident, In Vogue is playing, Free Your Mind, Red Light Special pops up. It's all this early to mid-90s R&B, which just works, and is they nailed the soundtrack.
It's good, and I compare this movie to like this basketball game where you're expecting this great matchup and you go in and it turns out that it ends up in a blowout and you're like, okay, so it was kind of disappointing. I wanted more out of this game, and I think it'll make a great airplane filler movie when people are sitting there going, what can I watch for 2 hours to kill, you know, to kill some time?
Full 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a full 2 hours. I do think that was a little too long for this particular film. But yeah, so it's not terrible. It's not bad. It's just, disappointing, I would say, is the word.
Well, our next film, I didn't see it, but I've seen it.
You have.
A couple years ago.
Because you made me see it.
I really connected and enjoyed a film from Norway called In Order of Disappearance, and starring Stellan Skarsgård as a father whose son is murdered by drug dealers, and he's the local hardcore snowplow man, you know, one of those really, really big machines that has to clear the roads and interstates in Norway. And just one by one, he ended up killing the entire crew from bottom to top using snowplow skills. And I just loved that film. It was so good. And apparently I'm not the only one who loved it, because Hollywood said, this is so good, we're going to Americanize it. We're going to remake it. We're going to replace Stellan Skarsgård with Liam Neeson, who's been in the news this week. And so, Hannah, how does the remake called Cold Pursuit, starring Liam Neeson, stack up?
It is a chilling case of deja vu. Dude. With Cold Pursuit. It is. I had no idea going into the screening on a very cold day in a very cold theater that Cold Pursuit would be a movie that I basically had seen because you made me watch it back in 2014.
And you're welcome, because it was good.
It was called In Order of Disappearance, or Kraftidioten, I believe. And so this foreign film out of Norway with a snowplow operator, mild-mannered snowplow operator named Nils Dickman, is now a mild-mannered snowplow operator out of Colorado named Nels Coxman.
Nels Coxman.
I mean, come on.
Love it.
The whole thing was, I'm sitting there with this sense of deja vu going, oh my gosh, this looks so familiar. And it was because after the very first on-screen death, this little in memoriam kind of slate comes up that gives the name and the nickname of this first victim. And I was like, that's a familiar looking device. By the fourth dead guy with some nickname, like, you know, there were all kinds of crazy names. They are Mustang and Sly and Limbo and Eskimo. And as all these people are getting knocked off one by one and these on-screen memoriams appear, more and more I realized that I had indeed seen this exact same movie before. And it is. I swear, it's the same director.
Ridiculous. As a director would remake his own film. I just find ridiculous.
It was. And so if you happen to have seen In Order of Disappearance and liked it, you come out of this movie going, why? I mean, it's literally, it felt like the exact same dialogue, the same kind of death and destruction and mayhem and carnage. I think Liam Neeson even is a good American replacement, but a replacement for Stellan Skarsgård. Like if you had asked me in 2014, well, who would be the person to play this Stellan Skarsgård character in an American remake? I probably would say, oh, you know, somebody like Liam Neeson. And that's exactly what it is. But the narrative, the structure, the direction, everything is exactly the same as it was in that 2014 original. So I just don't see why. And at least even like with the Upside remake that we saw a few weeks ago, that was the American version of a foreign film. That one at least spun a little differently. Like it, you know, it had some...
A little different. It was very similar.
It was very similar, but this, I mean, I really felt like they lifted, the dialogue was essentially the same. Laura Dern is completely wasted in this particular movie as the wife of Liam Neeson's character, because he's sort of lacking in communication skills. He's got a lot of other particular set of skills.
He probably speaks through his snowplow.
He does speak through his snowplow, and how this snowplow operator ended up with the kind of particular skills that would help him sort of avenge his son's death is not really very well explained. But the other like real female character that's kind of given a little bit of short shrift in this is Emmy Rossum plays this rookie detective. It sort of looks like something out of Fargo. And so to me, Cold Pursuit was like this mashup of Fargo and Taken. And if you just threw those two in a blender, maybe stirred in the original In Order of Disappearance movie, out would come Cold Pursuit.
I have no patience for these knockoff remakes that really add nothing and mostly take away from the original. So I'm not sad I miss this, and I'll never watch it, ever.
I'll be really curious to see if it's for the least discriminating of the Liam Neeson fan base. So if you loved if you just love a Liam Neeson action revenge thriller, and you are okay with The Commuter and Taken 3,
then
you might actually go out and see this one. But it is not.
If you're a fan of Taken 3 and The Commuter, why are you listening to this podcast?
The Commuter was okay to me. Lord. I got through that one, but that's the whole point is that, and I unfortunately Liam Neeson did not do himself any favors premiere week by recounting some sad story that makes him sort of look like a bit of a racist, and it was just bad timing, and so I'm not sure how this film, Cold Pursuit, will fit into the scheme of things. And the poster looks exactly like one of the films that we actually missed this week called Arctic, that looks like another very cold-related movie that's kind of looks like a castaway on a snowy mountaintop.
Yeah, I don't want to say anything more about Cold Pursuit. It'll be forgotten in the near term, and no one will remember it happened.
No, but if you did see In Order of Disappearance, you will absolutely know what this film is.
Our next segment is the Oscar-nominated short films. Now, a lot of people don't like these categories because they're not familiar with any of the films and they would just wish the Oscar telecast would move quickly through them. However, if you do watch them, you become very invested in them because you have not only you have your personal favorites, but you have ones you really don't want to win. And most of them are just profound and will stick with you for a while. And so you can become really invested. And usually, if you live in a medium to large size town, one art house cinema is playing these. I know not everyone's going to see every doc short, animated short, or live action short, but if you can pick one category, I even think it's worth doing that. That's what I used to do before I started doing this. I'd pick one category. I want to start with the doc shorts. Well, the first thing I noticed that two of them right off the bat seem to be remakes from 2017. There's one called Lifeboat, about picking up refugees crossing from Africa to Europe through the Mediterranean. It reminded me of 4.1 Miles, which was about the day in the life of a Greek Coast Guard captain. Mm-hmm. This one's about a German kind of non-governmental operation plucking people out of the Mediterranean before they drown. Another one's called Endgame, which you can watch actually right now on Netflix. It reminded me of something called Extremists. They're both about end-of-life decisions between patients and their doctors. Do I want to die at the hospital? Do I want to die at a hospice? When do you pull the plug? That one didn't connect me, and this one didn't connect me. I want to talk about the two really like.
Okay, but before I'm just going to tell you that Endgame was the only one that it just made me cry.
I didn't connect with that one bit.
Oh my gosh, I'm totally the opposite.
I really connected with A Night at the Garden, which actually the guy didn't have to film anything at all. He just took found footage and probably did a very good edit job on it. Because I did not know in 1939, 20,000 Nazi sympathizers and Nazis themselves showed up at Madison Square Garden for a rally full of Nazi flags and Heil Hitler signs, white power this, praise Nazi Germany that in America, in Madison Square Garden, and eerie connections to today. And it's only seven and a half minutes long.
7 minutes, yeah. But I had seen it recently, or some of that footage somewhere recently, so it was not completely new to me. And I have a hard time with it being in this particular category because of the fact that it really is just existing footage being shown to you.
But I bet it's never been edited like that.
No, but I would just have a hard time having...
It's like a found object.
It's a found object, and you just kind of look and you go, wow, we really need to learn from our past mistakes. And so it's a cautionary tale revisited, which is very important. But when you compare the 7 minutes of just revealed footage to these other more true-to-form mini documentaries... I just have a hard time putting that together in the same category and thinking that it should win over something that that really had to be created with a little more sort of a little more from scratch.
That was my runner-up. My absolute favorite documentary short this year is called Period End of Sentence. I had no idea that in India the greatest taboo above anything is menstruation. And the lack of or use of sanitary napkins. They just don't use them. They use whatever strips of cloth they can get their hands on and sneak off in the field during the day to change whenever they can. Some girls drop out of school because they don't have facilities or even privacy to take care of this. And most of the boys get it wrong. They don't even know what it is. The girls can't even say it. They can't even say the name. They just giggle. And it's like this great shame. I had no idea. So it's about these people who set up mini factories that anybody, even with no education, can work in to make
sanitary napkins.
And it shows them enjoying the process, and then they become saleswomen, and then they earn their own money. And you can see it's really starting to transform some dirt poor, rural, out of nowhere society that just can't even talk about the subject. And it was so fascinating to me. This one knocked my socks off.
It was pretty fascinating. I mean, really, who knew that a documentary on sanitary napkins could be so engaging? And yet it really is. This was Artie Chick's favorite as well. She reviewed it. And I think it was my second most favorite. Also just because it was uplifting and we'd been watching so much horrifyingly depressing material with a lot of these shorts. That to see something tell a really interesting, fascinating girl power story was just a breath of fresh air. And yeah, when you consider that subject matter, it was a pleasant surprise for sure. But for me, the other ones you did mention, like there was this one called Black Sheep that is, you know, it's a pretty sad story about race and acceptance and this guy who basically decides to be just like the white bullies that have this Nigerian guy who's been bullied by these whites, and he decides that the best way to survive is to become just like them, and it just forces him to take this turn, and it's just a very depressing narrative that this guy's recounting what his experience was. But for the reason, when I saw The End Game, which is on Netflix, part of it is just because what I do on a day-to-day basis is around family caregiving. So the whole issue of palliative care and hospice and anything that can help show what happens at end of life and to help reduce the fear and to really show what all the different members of the family are going through and having to make these final decisions. I just weeped my way through that one. It was it just pulled on my heartstrings more than anything else. It was the only one of these that really absolutely brought a legitimate tear to my eye. And so that's why my heart is pulling for Endgame. But then I also did enjoy End of Sentence as well.
So now I'm gonna say something I've never ever said about not just like a category of film. I recommend you do not go see the live action short films.
Oh,
don't skip them
unless you have a huge bottle of something much more strong than what we're drinking right now.
This is your argument. People go to the cinema to be entertained, to forget about life, to have a good time, maybe to smile. And yeah, you can go see a heavy drama but come out better on the other side, or even a weepy full-length documentary about something terrible but still come out and find some sort of catharsis. However, in 4 of the 5 live-action document or just live-action fiction shorts, I can't even think about them. They're so terrible. That we're talking
not terrible child.
I'm not talking about bad filmmaking,
distressing.
But I have problems with many of these, just with the filmmakers. Child death, child torture, child endangerment, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. I want to talk about a very specific one that's got a lot of controversy: Detainment. Detainment is based, it's a true crime story from 1993. 2 10-year-olds killed a 2-year-old boy. They abducted him from a mall, took him miles away, and savagely murdered him. It's the filmmaker didn't have to write any dialogue because it's based on actual transcripts. The film was made against the wishes of the dead boy's parents. An online petition has gathered 150,000 signatures to remove this as a nomination.
Wow.
I've never heard of a live-action short garnering such controversy. This is one of the most notorious crime events ever to happen in Britain, ever. It's still seared into people's memories there. People accused the filmmaker of humanizing and even sympathizing with the little murderers. I went and found out what happened to them later, by the way. Yeah, I can tell you offline if you want to know. It's so sickening. I was thinking about it on my commute home today, and I'm sorry I ever watched this film.
And yet, the first thing you did was go, oh, wait till you watch the live
action. Because I know you're going to watch it.
Oh, my God. I watched that first one, and I think I just texted you. I'm like, this is just, oh, my God, what did you put me through? Because you just feel like you've been put through the ringer. And it is just brutal to watch. It's depressing and distressing. And then each one successively, even though Detainment set this bar.
It's the worst one.
It's the hardest. It's the hardest because you're looking at these 10-year-old boys who did something so horrific. And I mean, the acting is phenomenal of these kids, but my God, I want to see them in something else because you do just feel completely spent and destroyed and distressed and depressed after watching that particular short. And so everything that followed, I would say
if I had to pick a favorite, and it's hard, it's very hard to pick a favorite, I think I would actually vote for Skin.
And I think that Skin might win. And the reason I would think Skin could win is because it's the only one that had anyone that I actually recognized in it.
No, it's not. You never recognize actors from short films that are nominated.
Why? No, but I did. Danielle McDonald was in this one.
You're not understanding me. Any year, you never recognize anyone from a cast, so why would you vote just because you recognize an actress?
No. That's ridiculous. I'm thinking about the voters who do vote, not for me personally.
They don't vote because they recognize an actress?
I'll tell you, when I saw it, I think that there might be some people who will just go, wow, that's, you know, Danielle McDonald, who you just saw in Dumplin' recently and was Patty Cakes. I'm just saying that it's the one that actually sort of took me out for a second of the film because I did recognize this person. And the first thing I needed to do is go and check and say, wow, is that the chick from Patty Cakes? But it's another one that just ends. It's this horrifying.
Skin is about white supremacist family who's raising, he's probably a 7 or 8 year old boy. And they're raising their boy in this white supremacist culture. They're teaching him to fire assault rifles, and they sport swastika tattoos. And the son watches his father commit a heinous crime against a black man right in front of the man's family. And it's the revenge that happens upon that guy, and then how that impacts the family later on, which is finally it's an ending that I enjoyed because finally something.
It was
just doesn't end in complete. It ends in misery. Don't get me wrong, but it's just a different kind of misery, like a cathartic. I'm good. I'm glad it's happened. Misery.
No, I agree because I think I saw that one right after Madre, which I didn't get the point at all. That was another one where you're listening. It's all taking place like in this apartment, and this poor mother is on the phone with her young boy,
six-year-old,
who was going off with her ex-husband, with his father on some beach vacation or something. And apparently the father has left him on some abandoned beach. And so you're following along, listening to this mother as her son's cell phone is dying, and she has no idea whether he's on some abandoned beach in Spain or France and nobody else is around. And she's going crazy, and you're just like caught up in, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then it takes this turn, and you get this sense of that there's possibly this predator, child predator out on the beach. And then the thing just kind of ends, and you're like, what the?
Well, because Madre, it's about what you don't know. You don't know. He's 6 years old, so his situational awareness is already low. So either this is the worst case scenario, and something happened to Dad, or Dad just ditched the kid, and there's a child predator looking at him, or this is completely innocent, and Dad's, like, right over there, and this is a guy, you know, you don't know.
You don't know, but it's another one that just ends, and you're just like...
Well, and the filmmaker, this is my second problem with a filmmaker in this category. Filmmakers have the power to provoke, and they can push you in any direction they want to, and they made a choice to push you in a very specific direction in Madre, and push and push and push and push. And it's like, okay, we're going to elicit a very specific reaction. And they do. So congratulations. What's the point of that? To prove you can do that?
Yeah.
Great. You're an amazing filmmaker. Yes, you can elicit reactions from the audience. But what for what end?
Well, and the same with the short Fauve, which is another one where it's like children in peril. And it ends, and I just wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be taken away from that one, but it was another one that just left me feeling really distressed. And so the only one that's not distressing is Marguerite, which, you know, is the sweetest sort of the bunch.
I figured that one might win just because everyone's so sick of the other four.
Yeah, and it's just kind of this sweet film about this old lady who's caretaker, this healthcare worker who comes in every day. The old lady discovers that her caregiver is a lesbian and is in some very loving relationship with another woman. And it triggers these memories that this old woman had of an unrequited love that she had with a woman back, you know, decades earlier, when it just would not have been an acceptable lifestyle choice. And so she's it's very sweet about acceptance and this. What a different time this caregiver is getting to live in, that she's able to openly be in this relationship. And so the older woman is just kind of feeling very empathetic towards her. And it's very melancholy. So it's melancholy after horror. Insanely horrifying shorts.
During the Oscar telecast, this is the one category I will be glued. Yeah, I'm interested in actor and picture and whatever. I'm fascinated by what the Academy chooses to do here.
And I hope they show, I hope they announce this one during the regular awards telecast, because, yeah, now that I've seen, you know, I invested 3 hours in seeing all of these shorts, I really do have a vested interest in knowing which ones actually then take home the prize. But they are the toughest to choose among, because they're these mini movies, and they're all, it's, you know, you just can't compare. It's apples to oranges, especially with the animated ones.
No, like, we all know who's going to win Best Supporting Actress, Regina King. But you never know who's going to win the short films. That's always a toss-up. Mm-hmm. Now, the animated films, obviously the big elephant in the room is Bao. Every year Pixar usually has one, and this is the CGI Pixar entry this year. Actually, the other four are all hand-drawn. This is the only computer-generated one. And Bao premiered before the Incredibles 2 movie, and it split audiences. I loved it. I loved everything about it. I connected with it. And Hannah, I believe, said, kids won't get it.
I said kids didn't get it. I saw this short originally in front of Incredibles 2, and it was like 8 minutes long, and you had antsy kids who were ready for Incredibles 2 to start.
They always get a cartoon, though.
But this was not a standard cartoon. This was one that's for adults. It is not a, it was not a theme that kids could even begin to understand what they were saying. And so it's got, you know, it's themes of empty nest syndrome and a woman who ends up having sort of like a fight with her her son as he grows up. And it's, I mean, it's heartwarming. I liked it better the second time. So I got way more of it having seen it as part of all of these shorts than I did when I saw it in the theater originally. And part of it was that I think, just like the kids, I was reacting to the fact that I just did not think it was the appropriate short to put in front of Incredibles 2, considering the age range of the kids that were there waiting for that movie to begin. So I do think that Bao, you know, always has a bit of the edge with the Pixar animation because it's the best looking of the bunch, but it was not my favorite of the bunch.
Bao is actually the first Pixar film ever directed by a woman. But actually, I don't think it's going to win.
I don't think so.
It's not my what I think is going to win is actually not my favorite. I'll tell you what I think is going to win. My favorite is One Small Step. And it's pretty short. It's about a doting father and his daughter's astronaut dreams. It's bittersweet. It's cathartic. But I just really, there's no dialogue. I just really enjoyed watching this single dad raise his daughter in a very caring, deliberate manner. There's something about shoes in there and how everything, she doesn't really notice until he's gone.
How much he really was doing for her. He was like a single dad in all those years that he was really supporting her.
It's just a wonderful little film.
Yeah.
It's probably the best film out of the 15 we're talking about.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but it was my favorite of the animated shorts.
What I predict will win is a film called Weekends, about a son who shuttle, you know, during on weekdays he lives with mom, and on weekends he lives with dad. And he's obviously quite young because he doesn't truly understand why he shuttles back and forth, and he gets mostly impressions instead of real life dialogue. Like, mom gets a boyfriend, and it turns out he's not a very nice guy, and you can see what the boyfriend looks like through the son's eyes. Dad drives this really big Cadillac and must always be listening to Dire Straits' Money for Nothing, because that's what dads do. And it's seeing the world through his eyes and what he cannot possibly understand, but how he tries to interpret it. So I think Weekends is going to surprise.
Really? I don't think so. That was actually my least favorite of the bunch, and I think the one that was sort of your lighthearted one of the bunch was this one, Animal Behavior.
There's no way that's going
to
win.
No, but it was a nice, again, it was just a relief to see one just cute kind of short out of all of these. And when you put a bunch of, it's just a bunch of animals who are together in group therapy. You've got a praying mantis with relationship issues, and you've got a gorilla with anger management issues, and
each animal
a pig
has their
with
problem.
Eating issues.
The cat is obsessive compulsive about licking himself.
Yeah,
and the leech is clingy.
It is, but it's cute. So
there's one of these every year. There's always one animated one that's just funny.
Exactly. But I'll tell you, I mean, those are a freaking relief after you watch some of the stuff. And then there was this other one, Late Afternoon, that was very poignant, that, you know, is middle of the road. It just, another caregiver-related one, so this woman with dementia.
Reminded me of Marguerite.
It did remind me of Marguerite. So it was sort of, this woman with dementia whose daughter is, you know, adult daughter is kind of helping care for her. And her memories going back over the years to some of their time together. Another one that's just melancholy and sweet.
Well, Late Afternoon, I actually found more interesting than I thought I would, because it visually shows maybe what Alzheimer's and dementia looks like. Something spurs a long ago. She has no idea where she is now or who this woman is taking care of her. But something spurs a long ago memory, and she goes back to being a child. And then for the next 5 minutes in the room she's in, she's actually a child, because that's the memory is real. And then only later, through a certain memory, does she realize, oh, this is my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then she realizes, it's quite sad.
It is.
But it's interesting to see someone's visual interpretation of dementia.
Yeah, and so with the animated shorts, this to me is the toughest of them all to figure out what should win, because I just felt that they're so unique and they're different, but each was an interesting little story. I didn't dislike any of them, which was a nice thing. And I just think that but I don't want Weekends to win. To me, that one was not.
It's not that I want it to win. I just think it will. I really want One Small Step to win.
I would love for One Small Step to win, so I can agree with you there.
Hey, look at us. All right. A bit of a scattershot episode, especially at the end there, but let's see if we can recap this The Lego Movie 2.
Wait,
colon.
I do have to get in Brett's agree or disagree.
Oh, I forgot. I can't. I was almost going to do that. I have two myself, so we can do this quickly.
Yeah, just a real quick agree or disagree because, heck, we've said. Well, that let we're me do a very fast one
from today. Mm-hmm. R.I.P. Albert Finney.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I know him from Aaron Brockovich, Big Fish, and Miller's mm-hmm. Crossing. My parents know him from Scrooge. However, and he was nominated for 5 Oscars, by the way, but never won. No matter what happens, as, you know, usually actors from decades ago, you only know them from one film. No matter how big their filmography is, no matter what Albert Finney does or did, he will only be known as Daddy Warbucks from Annie. That's it. Nothing else. That's it. He'll just agree or disagree. He will only be dead. 20 years from now, Albert Finney was Daddy Warbucks.
For some people, for me, Albert Finney was Aaron Brockovich. You know, he was the mentor in Aaron Brockovich.
Not 20 years
from
now.
No, I mean, you're right. People will remember what they were most, you know, I certainly wasn't familiar with his filmography from the 60s. And so, yeah, I...
Because it didn't hold up. It's gone.
It's a lot of it's gone.
But 1982's Annie,
I don't know,
is still around.
I think Aaron Brockovich will still... I think Aaron Brockovich will still be around, and that will be the one that people remember. All right. But yes, rest in peace, Albert Finney, because no matter how you slice it, he was a great character actor, great actor. And, whenever he did pop up on the screen, he was always good. And so it's a loss. But yeah, he was nominated 5 times, but never actually went to a single Oscar ceremony because he didn't see the point of going to something where there was no smoking, no drinking, and the likelihood of winning was so low. So
yeah. You
go, Albert. I will just say that, so from Brett in New York, we got the agree or disagree. And this is something that's just sort of a sign of the times, I think, with the highfalutin theaters that are popping up now where you're able to eat and drink and lounge at the same time. Mm. And he said, the waiters serving food and drinks and dropping off the checks at dine-in movie theaters are just as annoying as the talkers and the texters that they ban in these theaters.
I disagree.
So
I disagree. If you go to these theaters, these really high-end theaters where you get not only maybe a blanket and a pillow and a free bag of popcorn, but then order a meal and alcohol, you know what you're getting. You absolutely know what you're getting. I don't know if I'm going to get talkers or sneezers, or the old people who think they're whispering but they're yelling. You just don't know what you're going to get. You know what you're going to get tableside service at this.
I guess pick your poison. You got to go to a theater that isn't serving, that doesn't have full service. If you know that you don't want to hear any additional sound. But I'll tell you, it pissed me off. We were at a screening the other night of Isn't It Romantic? And the guy next to me seemed to think that just because you have your screen dimmed, you can text the entire time that the movie is going. And this is in the press row. And I tapped him on the shoulder finally about an hour and a half into the film. Actually, it was only an hour and a half long, so maybe it was an hour into the film. And I said, you know, can you put your phone away, please? And the guy was like, I appreciate you. I appreciate you. And yeah, I hear what you're saying. And he goes,
I was wondering what that was.
And he goes,
I was like, what are you doing?
He goes, I'd put it away, but I have to text somebody. And I was like, what the heck is that supposed to mean? And so he was being very courteous. I was very courteous. And then he was very courteous in his response. And he did, in fact, at that point, not take the phone out again. But I could tell it was killing him not to be texting.
Yeah, it's like, why even go to the movies? Like, what are you doing?
But, you know, this the whole idea that we have the security people come out at the beginning of the screening and
charade.
Tell you.
What
it's a total charade because the phones still show up throughout theater, you know, throughout screenings. And I do wish that that there was a little more common courtesy and self-policing among the people in the seats because obviously you're not going to get the enforcement from
cell phones, like a fight erupts. So
yeah.
I'll never call someone out because 97% of the time, how dare you tell me to put my phone away? Like it's my fault.
Yeah, I waited and waited and waited and I bit my tongue for so long. And I finally reached the point where I'm like, you know, you haven't looked up at the screen at all for this movie.
Well, I'm not allowed to say anything yet, but I understand why.
No, I disagree, but on that one. So anyway, it's you know, but I do think it's a conversation that that will continue about cinema etiquette.
All right. Well, the only thing I'll say on a wrap up this week is don't go see the live action shorts. Because you're listening to the rest of the podcast. You don't need to wrap up. Don't go to see the live action shorts.
Not unless you really, really, really like getting incredibly depressed and distressed.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.